Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For the last decade and more, a plane ticket to paradise or just to see the family has been within reach of many millions of Americans. Now, high jet fuel costs are crunching the airlines. They're cutting jobs, grounding planes, and ramping the price of that boarding pass way, way up. The country has hardly begun to take on board what that may mean. This hour on Point, the looming end of affordable air travel and what that may mean for the way Americans interact and live for the radius of our lives. Joining me first today from Ann Arbor, Michigan is Micheline Maynard. She's business correspondent and airline industry reporter for the New York Times. Mickey Maynard, thanks very much for being with us again.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So are we back to the jet set? I mean, are we headed back to the time when getting on a plane was something for the few, the elite, the privileged?
Well, I remember that very well because my dad worked for American Airlines, and I grew up flying what they call non-rev, which were when the airline employees could fly for free. We had to dress up. My brother had a briefcase.
Oh, boy.
And it was a very special experience. And, of course, that all kind of went away in 1978 when the airlines were deregulated. Now, it was very special for me to be able to fly as a child. Most kids didn't in the 70s. But now we saw democratization of the air.
We saw it, and millions of people participated in it, and never mind the briefcase and sport coat. You know, it's sweatpants, and let's go to grandma's house, wherever she may live. What is happening? Why are airlines grounding lots and lots and lots of planes rather than flying? Flying's their business.
Well, there are two reasons. One reason is the economy in general, because you have to think about all the businesses that have cut back on travel. You think about all the people whose budgets are squeezed maybe because of their mortgage situation. So that's one factor. But the bigger factor is really what's happened to jet fuel. And jet fuel prices are up 84% year over year, according to one of the global air groups. And that's a huge expense for the airline. It has become their number one expense. It used to be labor and other things were more expensive for them than fuel, but now by far it's jet fuel.
So we're reading that because of that and their inability so far, or their decision not to hike fares fully yet, they're losing money on every flight, maybe every lots of fares.
Right. We haven't really seen the impact on the industry at large yet in terms of profits, because the first quarter was actually pretty good. They got through the first quarter and most of them made money, but United Airlines did not. They surprised Wall Street by losing about $537 million. And I think that was the warning bell that things were about to get worse. They actually may get through the summer all right, but when the fall and winter come, that's when air travel typically falls off, except for Thanksgiving and Christmas. And that could be a very bloody time for the airlines.
Now, they're going to put hundreds of airplanes on the ground, not even fly them, and everything I'm reading here says fare hikes are coming. Do we have any idea how high, how far, where this ends?
Well, we've had about 10 rounds of just fare hikes, and we haven't even talked about the new charges yet, but fares have gone up about 10 or 12 times so far this year. And if you remember just a couple of years ago when the low-fare airlines were expanding, the airlines might try to institute a fare hike on a Friday night, and they had to push it back by Sunday because nobody would go along with it. Now we're seeing fares go up. We've seen an average increase of about 16% in what are called leisure fares, which are people who buy their tickets in advance and try to get those cheap fares. But even business class fares are up 5%. Now, obviously, this isn't enough to cover the rising cost of jet fuel.
If jet fuel goes along with oil now, you know, headed toward what we're told, 150 by the 4th of July, maybe Goldman Sachs saying maybe 200 in the foreseeable future, dollars a barrel. And of course, that flows through to jet fuel. What does that portend for? How will airlines deal with that? I'm reading top executives here talking about what sounds like accepting the end of the era of supermass travel, accepting that they're going to have fewer, more well-heeled, high fare-paying customers.
Well, in one sense, it won't be a bad thing as far as the comfort of some customers, because if you remember back to last summer. It was a record summer for air travel. Every seat is full. If your flight got canceled, it might take you 2 or 3 days to get home. So there might be a few empty middle seats on planes as a result of that. But the other issue to keep in mind is that we had this great swelling of the airline industry, and people got to expect that they could leave the house at 6 in the morning, and by 9 in the morning, they'd be halfway across the country. They could leave their vacation home at 6 at night and be home before sundown, essentially. We may not have as easy of a lifestyle as that, at least in the near future.
2.7 million fewer people flying this summer than in 2007, the Air Transport Association is predicting. You quote Tim Winship at SmarterTravel.com, saying air travel will be less democratic from here on out. What does that mean exactly?
Well, it used to be that you could go online and pick almost any place in the country and fly there for less than $400. The airlines love to send emails out saying, do you have plans for the weekend? Well, if you don't, here's a fare to New York for $78. Now, there will be some of those cheap fares left for people who can spend hours and hours hunting for fares or set up those little programs on their computer that send them an email message as soon as a cheap fare arrives. But for the most part, there are a lot of people that only fly, say, at Christmas time and maybe a big trip during the summer. And I think a lot of them will be shocked when they go online and see that the ticket that cost them $250 last year will cost them $400 this year.
Charles Lindbergh called flying a godlike act, and it surely was at one point, but it became to seem very ordinary. It sounds as though you're describing the era in which it may again become less ordinary, that people, instead of flying several times a year, may fly once, twice, or not at all.
Well, I think it'll be a lot less common to just get on a plane and go somewhere. I think people will be planning their trips in advance, limiting their trips. Businesses are very important in all of this, and you're seeing a cutback in business travel. So perhaps the skies will be a little bit less empty, although remember, they're retiring airplanes. So as the supply of passengers goes down, the supply of planes also goes down, and it's to the airline's best interest to try to keep whatever planes they have left full. So the comfort factor, in at least for a while, may not be there. It may be somewhere down the road.
Fewer planes in the sky, that has to ultimately mean fewer travelers. They're pretty full already, and maybe a change in lifestyle for millions and millions of Americans, a change in expectations about what are the sort of geographic radius of our lives, maybe. Micheline Maynard in Detroit with the New York Times. Please stand by. I want to turn to Denver, Colorado, and Andrew Goetz. He's professor and chair of the geography department at the University of Denver, focuses on transportation and urban landscapes. Professor Goetz, thanks very much for being with us.
Sure. Thanks, Tom. Glad to be here.
What does it mean for what we've come to think of as the American way of life if air travel goes from being pretty darn affordable to something that only the privileged can afford?
Yeah, well, it's a major change in lifestyle, that's for sure. I mean, for the last, I'd say 30, maybe to 40 years or so, we've seen fares generally been coming down. And if you adjust for inflation, it's been pretty remarkable that fares have been coming down over this period of time. To some degree, it's almost inevitable that the fares are going to have to start coming up, even when accounting for inflation. And, of course, the jet fuel is the big factor behind that. So we've had a long period where fares have been really low, and I think finally now it's starting to catch up to maybe where it should have been all along.
When you look out at this country, at American vacation and travel patterns, at American family dispersal patterns, you know, maybe mom and dad in Chicago and kids in New York and California and you name it, at second home ownership, business patterns, real estate, all the rest, how much have those decades of cheap air travel shaped the way we live in geographic terms?
Well, it's quite a bit. One of the biggest factors that businesses and residences, people make decisions based on are on travel costs. And it happens at different scales. At the scale we're talking about, the national scale, people have felt a lot freer in terms of where they can live. It's contributed to us, the United States, becoming a very hyper-mobile society. I've read statistics that show that people move on average. I think half of all Americans move at least once every 5 years. And that's a pretty high rate of movement. A lot of that movement is within a given metropolitan area, which themselves have become more spread out and sprawling because of lower transport costs. But the same thing's happening at the national scale, too, where people can move from city to city, but still be able to maintain those linkages to their families, wherever they happen to be. And, of course, the lower airfares have been a big factor behind that.
You know, I know it's true for me. I mean, I've got family spread from Savannah and the Carolinas down through Texas, out into California, up into Alaska, all over the country. And for years, it hasn't really seemed a problem. If you wanted to see somebody, I mean, it costs some money, but you could do it. Do you think we may see a kind of reclustering of families, of businesses, of American activity if airfares and high oil start to cut off that path?
I think we're going to start to see some of it. It's going to be marginal at first, but the decisions that people make about how many trips they are going to be able to make in a given year, it's going to have to be affected by the higher fares. People are going to have to make those decisions. Instead of maybe taking 5 or 6 trips, maybe they're only going to take 2 or 3 trips. And so it's going to start having an impact and maybe begin to affect long-term decision-making about where you want to be and how isolated you want to be from the rest of your family or from business activities or other things.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about airline cutbacks and a new vista of Americans maybe flying much less and what that means for the economy, lifestyles, family, real estate, the end, perhaps, of affordable air travel. Micheline Maynard is with us. She's correspondent for the New York Times, covers the airline industry. Andrew Goetz is with us from Denver, Colorado, professor of geography at the University of Denver. Let's go to Laura in Des Moines, Iowa. Hi, Laura. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom. Thank you.
Yeah,
I was just going to say, this is so, like, I'm dealing with this situation right now. We've got family. I'm here in Des Moines. We've got family in Florida and Atlanta, and we're not going to go see them this summer. It's just too expensive. And so that's kind of sad, but we'll get over it. We'll just work something else out. The other thing I was going to say is here in Des Moines, there seems to be kind of a revitalization of the urban area here. And I'm wondering, one of your guests touched on that earlier, that people might start moving back into the cities again. And I think that could be a really good thing if, as long as we keep ahead of, you know, the environment and all the smog.
Yeah, a million ways in which higher oil, you can really feel it changing life and kind of at a fast pace. Laura, when you look forward and you think about your family in Georgia, in Florida, your own travel plans, do you imagine that you're going to fly as readily, easily, see that family as often in the next 10 years as you have in the last?
I don't think so, but I do see that driving seems to be more attractive to me. I mean, if it's going to take almost the same amount of money, why not see the country? And I think that road travel is actually a lot of fun, and if we can get, you know, lower fuel efficiency cars, then I think that would be really great. So maybe that'll be something new for a lot of people.
On the other hand, $4 a gallon and hard to load the whole family, plus I don't know what, the golf clubs into a Prius. We'll see what happens. Laura, thanks for your call. Let's get one more from Upton, Massachusetts. Susan, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
Curious to hear what the experts think is going to happen to the pockets of our country that are so tourist-oriented, like skiing in Colorado or Disney World in Florida, when we can pack up the whole family and take them to these places, and we can't do that in the future.
Let's pick it up. Micheline Maynard, you follow airlines. What about the parts of the country that are dependent upon those airlines to deliver lots and lots and lots of people?
Well, if there's demand for flights, there'll be flights. I don't think places like Orlando and around Branson, Missouri, places like that have to worry as long as people want to go there. But we did a story recently on small communities across the United States that have lost flights completely. There are about 30 cities that have no more air service that had it a year ago. And we're seeing cities like New Haven, Connecticut go down to one airline and frequencies only in the travel season. So, for example, you could fly to Colorado during ski season, some of the small towns there, but maybe not during the summer. Same with Florida. So I think another thing people have to watch out for is not losing service completely, but losing what's called frequency of service. So instead of 5 flights a day, you only have 2 or 3 or even 1.
And yet we're kind of assuming that if there's demand, somebody will respond to it. But if the price of those flights gets too high, what happens to areas of the country that have built their economies around mass tourism. Our caller Susan asks about the, let's say, the Disney World, or, you know, skiing, which requires practically transcontinental flights for a lot of people.
Yeah, that's right. No, I would think that people in the resort communities are very concerned about what's going on with airline fares, because so much of their business relies upon people coming in by air to those places. So anyone involved in tourism, in resort areas, recreation, they have to be concerned about what's going on. I know that they have in the past worked with the airlines in trying to make sure that there is a good good air service supply at lower fares, and they may need to continue to work with the airlines to ensure that that's going to happen. But to the extent that airlines are going to be charging higher fares, again, people are going to have to make those tough decisions about how many of these trips they're going to be able to make. And maybe in the past they've been able to do a ski trip and a trip to Disneyland and maybe one other. Well, maybe in the future they're only going to be able to do two of those, or maybe only one of those. So it's going to have an impact.
You know, there's a lot of real estate issues related to those issues. Second homes, timeshares. What about that? What happens to real estate prices in, I don't know, Florida or Arizona if, let's say, grandparents get afraid to move there because they're afraid the kids won't be able to come and travel, or timeshares don't sell as easily because the price of getting to the timeshare goes up, the airfare goes up, Professor?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, oh, I agree. There are many, many industries that are affected by air travel, by the airline industry, and resort is one, and real estate is another one. A lot of decisions about second homes are made on the basis of how easy it is to get there, and if it becomes that much more difficult, that becomes a factor in whether people are going to actually invest in those second homes. So, you know, I would think the real estate industry is also very concerned about what's going on.
Ripple effects in lots of directions. Let's take a call from Burlington, Vermont, and Landel. Landel, you're on the air.
Hi. I would just like to say that I think that this crisis that we're having with airline prices right now is really just a bigger part of the fuel crisis that we're having, and that we need to look for an alternative source of energy to power our airplanes, just as we need to find an alternative source of energy to power our cars, and get off our dependence on oil and look towards other sources.
Let us pick it up. Mickey Maynard, what about it? The technical feasibility of alternative fuel sources. Ethanol has become very controversial, but it's out there. Can you pour that into an airplane and have it fly?
Not right at the moment. Just a little bit of thing for people to understand. Jet fuel is essentially kerosene. And so when you have the refining that would go into gasoline, you have to then refine it again into kerosene. Those big tanks at the airports are basically loaded with jet fuel. And at the moment, there isn't a way for, say, an airline to say, I want to fly on ethanol, fill my tank with ethanol. It would be mixing in with everybody's tanks, essentially. Now, Richard Branson at Virgin Airlines did conduct a test flight where I believe the plane flew on biofuels and it flew successfully. And this is certainly something that Boeing and Airbus and Bombardier and the other aircraft manufacturers are looking at. We're probably farther from it in aviation than we are in automobiles. And I think it's very interesting, having covered the auto industry and watched what they've done with alternative fuels, to now see that applying to the airlines. And I do think that there'll be all kinds of things that'll be looked at over the next 15 years. But remember, it takes the aviation companies years to develop new aircraft. We could be well into the next decade before we see anything like that.
And talk about high octane. I mean, people are modifying automobiles and trucks to pour French fry, old oil, you know, French fry oil in there. Presumably, jets need just about the highest volatility fuel you can come by. They want the sort of pure, as you say, super refined, real deal. Not easy to find an alternative to that.
The other thing you have to remember, Tom, is that an aircraft is many, many, many moving parts, and there are very strict safety standards imposed by the FAA and the government on airplanes. So this is not an area where you can experiment very easily with one or two planes. You really have to do it in conjunction with the federal government and the aviation companies. So I do think it'll be quite a while before we see anything on that front.
Let's take a call from Grundy Center, Iowa, and Jan. Jan, you're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just want to introduce this is a couple of other variables to the discussion. This is a very complicated topic. But I just returned from presenting at a conference on peak oil. I'm a professor at the University of Northern Iowa in counselor education.
Mm-hmm.
So peak oil talks about how supply could be a big issue. We may, and this may be a period that we're coming into where we've actually plateaued in world production, and this could have huge implications. The other thing, so I want to know if you're, what you think about that. The other thing is, I think that there could be some real positive things that come from slowing down in our society and being localized, as the other caller mentioned. So just wanted to hear your response to those two things.
Thanks very much, Jan. Andrew Goetz, how about it? What if this, you know, is not just a higher fares right now, not just some grounded planes, but we're really talking about alternative fuels a long way off, peak oil, supply constraints? I mean, when you look at the map of this country and think about where we're headed in terms of oil, fossil fuel energy constraints, how do you see it reshaping that map of human activity?
Yeah, well, I think it's a huge, huge thing, issue. I agree with the caller about the peak oil situation. I think what we're experiencing now is different from what we experienced back in the 1970s. During that time, we were able to recover a little bit with regards to finding new sources. I think we're going to be able to do that to some degree this time, but I don't think it's going to be to the extent that it was the first time around. I don't think we're going to be going back down to less than a dollar a gallon for gas like we did.
Nobody seems to expect that. But I mean, that part we get, but the implications of it are so many and potentially so large, it's hard to take on board. I mean, do you see the map of human settlement in this country changing?
Yeah, I do. I think it can. People are going to have to make smarter choices about where they live, where they work, what they do. One of the callers previously talked about returning back to the cities, and I think to some degree that will be happening within our metropolitan areas, and then at the national scale, I think people are going to be making harder choices about where exactly they're going to be living and what they value in terms of proximity. So I think it will have profound changes across the board.
Mickey Maynard, are airline executives thinking about this peak oil thing? I mean, what if it's just plain not there or not there at a price that any but really privileged few can afford?
Everyone is thinking about it in the airline industry. They're looking at it literally from the nose of the plane back to the tail and from the tarmac up to 50,000 feet. And every airline has someone in charge of these environmental issues that's looking at what they can do. Take extra water off the plane. Take magazines off the plane. Get lighter seats. Don't run the plane in the tarmac on the engines. Have the little tuggers take it out to the runway. So they're looking at this all over. And I want to just add one thing about this whole issue of reurbanization. When I was covering the auto industry, Toyota has studied this, and they found 60 communities across the country where this trend is already happening, where people are moving from the big house in the suburbs to the loft downtown. Well, when you have a big house in the suburbs, you might have a 3-car garage. When you have a loft downtown, you might have one parking space. What kind of a car will you want? Will you want the big SUV or will you want the Prius? When the kids come to visit, will they take mass transit to see you rather than drive their car since there's no place for them to park their car? And we've already seen that mass transit systems in this country are seeing greater and greater usage, and they're not prepared for that. So we do have sort of this ripple effect throughout the economy from what's going on.
And what if they don't come to visit at all? If they're in Omaha and you're in Augusta, Georgia, that's a flight in maybe more than they can afford. Let's get a call from Framingham, Massachusetts. Richard, you're on the air.
Hi. I was a little disappointed, and I don't know if trains are a reasonable alternative to airplanes, but when the Acela came out, and I thought it was going to actually be real modern high-speed travel train, and it just...
High-speed rail, yeah.
It isn't high-speed rail. It's higher-speed rail than we had before, but it's really nothing along the lines of what the French or the Japanese have. And the other thing is just as far as these trips that take longer to go, I think we need to look at our vacation policy. I don't mind taking, my family's in Chicago, I don't mind driving or taking the train, but I better have more than, you know, 2 weeks of vacation a year.
Good luck getting that if the economy is in trouble, but I hear you. Who wouldn't wish for it, and it takes time to get there? Let's get another call on the train front from Nashville. Nancy, you're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I wanted to make a comment with that, too. I really feel like it's high time we have more travel choices, and I would personally love to see some kind of investment in our infrastructure to have bullet train type travel. I just think, I don't understand why other parts of the world would have it, but we don't. And maybe, you know, this fuel situation will perhaps spur larger infrastructure investment and that kind of, you know, less, I understand, inner city rail, but I'm talking about big
city to city.
Yes, in large, you know, parts of like Western USA where you have big spaces between cities, and I know they have it on the East Coast, but, you know, I'll take my your comments off.
Yeah, but our caller on the East Coast in Framingham, Massachusetts, saying, yes, they've got it, but it's not that fast. He's not satisfied. Andrew Goetz, what about train travel as a potential alternative to air if jet fuel just goes, you know, so far out of sight that there aren't planes to move masses of people? Can trains pick up the slack in this country? Is there a readiness to make that passenger infrastructure investment? And if the country made that investment, would train travel be prohibitively expensive?
Mm-hmm. I think there is a real feeling that the time has come to invest in rail systems. We're seeing it starting to happen now. And I think with the price of fuel going up the way it is, I think there's now much more of an economic argument for doing it. Part of the problem has been that for so long, with low oil prices, there just wasn't the incentive to develop what are very high-cost train systems. But as the price of oil keeps going up, 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 it becomes a much more feasible alternative. It just takes a very heavy investment on the front end. But once you've got it, though, it's a very fuel-efficient mode of transport and can be competitive with air travel, especially up to, I'd say about intermediate distances, maybe 300, 400 miles or so. Trains can be very competitive with airlines. Anything that's much beyond that, airlines are going to still have the advantage in terms of speed. But high-speed rail, I think the time is well past for us to have been investing in this technology.
But, Micheline, do airline executives see that coming? Do they anticipate competition on that front? American distances are not European distances. It's thousands of miles, you know, maybe between where someone's home is and where their kids are or where they want to go. Does train look like a real mass alternative for long-distance travel at the volume air carriers have carried in this country?
Well, I don't think it is right now for cross-country trips because it just simply takes too long. And I think anyone who's taken Amtrak for a trip of over 5 or 6 hours will tell you that, you know, an airplane looks awfully attractive after that. But I will say that on either coast, from Los Angeles to San Francisco and up to Seattle, from Boston to New York down to Washington and even down to Florida, that's where the trains give the airlines a real run for their money. And I think there are a lot of New Yorkers who just jump on the train now to go to Washington rather than deal with the shuttle. And the same thing will be true on the West Coast between Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Seattle. I think that as people are thinking about, see, this is the difference between now and possibly 30 years ago. People are really starting to think about it. I've started to use the mileage calculator on my car to try to figure out, okay, if I make one run out to go to the farmer's market and back, can I do four other things while I'm making that run rather than just that one trip out? And I think that that's the kind of thing as Americans start to think about this isn't, it isn't so much rail versus air, it's lifestyle versus the way we used to be.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about airline cutbacks and a new vista of Americans maybe flying much less, and what that means for the economy, for lifestyles, family, real estate, if we're facing the end of affordable air travel. We've been joined by Micheline Maynard. She's a business correspondent for the New York Times, based, joining us today from Detroit. Andrew Goetz, professor of geography, chair of the geography department at the University of Denver, joins us from Colorado. You can join us as well. Let's go right now to Seabrook, New Hampshire. And David, you're on the air, David.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm a frequent flyer, and I've actually noticed fares going up quite drastically over the last 2.5 years, and in some cases more than doubling. And if prices continue to rise at the rate that they have been, it's going to actually force some business changes
for
our customers.
So you're saying not just your lifestyle, but business itself and the way people do business?
Oh, yeah.
Like what?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, why can't you just get online and do it online, get on the phone and do it that way?
No, not all of it. You know, sometimes face-to-face really has a big effect. And in some of the work that I do, you know, I'm in the imaging industry where mm-hmm. we actually look at medical images, and yeah, seeing is believing. So, and seeing what they're doing. So that necessitates flying to visit people. And if prices continue to increase, I mean, fares that used to cost $200 to $300 are now double. And you know, now a flight to Europe is more than $1,000. And that's, you know, booking out, you know, 6-8 weeks in advance.
A friend of mine whose father was flying to Paris on business class, $9,000 this week, David. I just heard this morning. Let's get another call from San Francisco. Ben, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that I do travel from L.A. to San Francisco, and San Francisco is not designed to have any Amtrak service. If you take Amtrak to San Francisco, they stick you on a bus from Oakland to San Francisco. I think in California that there's this political culture of the individual, the car, and it makes it really hard to develop a kind of comprehensive statewide mass transit policy with transit, with train transit.
But let me ask you, Ben, California is not a little state. It's a big one. And so flying might make sense from San Francisco to L.A., though a train would be nice. But if flights become really expensive, how do you think life will change in California? If they don't have train service you like, flights go over the moon, what happens?
It just gets more difficult to travel. People will take cars. The transit times will increase. The traffic is really bad as it is. And the mass transit alternatives, there's just, I think, a lukewarm effort on the part of the state and the government to encourage people to get out of their cars because people love their cars. It's part of their lifestyle and who they are. And, I mean, it's a very integral part of living in California is having your car.
Yeah, they love their cars, but $4 gas, and that may go higher, too. We could be looking at a real era of change here. Let's go to the other coast, Charleston, South Carolina. And Carl, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm working. I'm just going to make a quick statement and then get my get the response off the air.
Okay.
Yeah, I heard someone about a half hour ago call in and ask about alternative fuels, and I'm surprised your panel didn't get the news release about 2 weeks or so ago where the Air Force apparently is not too far away from starting to use alternative fuels in their aircraft. And unfortunately, I can't remember exactly what they're using. I mean, it may even be something like liquid coal. You know, I'm not even sure exactly what it is. But at least, you know, they're doing something to keep the aircraft going, and, you know, it seems like that our air industry could at least follow suit.
Could use it. Let's hope somebody leads the way and figures out a really efficient way to do that. Let's see. I bet Mickey Maynard knows something about that, but we've got a caller on the same front, Carl. Let me go to Warren, Vermont. And Ben, what do you know, Ben?
Hi, Tom. Yeah, hi. The caller's correct. The Air Force has been looking at a whole series of alternative fuels. One of them is biodiesel from algae, for example,
yes.
Which is potentially much, much more efficient per unit land area than, say, ethanol. And there's other couplings here, too. I think we're looking at the possibility of massive deployment of hybrids and plug-in hybrids for transportation in the near future.
When you say hybrids, though, do you mean automobiles or hybrid jets?
Yes, I mean for automobiles, but the point is that if we really deploy those, there will be a lot less demand on the fuel side for oil.
You're thinking everybody taking their summer vacation in a Prius or something instead of in an airplane?
Well, it doesn't have to be a Prius. It could be a hybrid of some type. And hopefully a plug-in hybrid, that could cause a very large decrease in the demand on oil and would free up a lot. So even if we didn't have the jet fuel in the relatively near term, phasing in those things would ease up the demand and would potentially lower the cost a lot. And actually, really, I think the current high price situation is a very good thing. We just haven't had the political will up till now. I think due to problems in our structure of government to be able to get these things deployed, but we've got a whole range of alternatives just waiting in the wings.
High price may be a good thing, but if you've got family spread across the country like I do, I'm thinking, well, how am I going to see them? Mickey Maynard, jet fuel made from biodiesel from algae. Why algae?
You know what? This is something I've just been hearing about in the last couple of weeks, and I don't want to mislead anybody with my lack of knowledge. So let me do a little bit more research, and the next time we talk about this, we can go into a little bit more further. But as the callers were saying, there definitely is research going on in these areas. But just remember, that all of this is the part of aviation that's still regulated. And so for airlines, for all those flights to switch over to something like this, will take government involvement. So it's good that the Air Force is doing this first, and then DOT, the Department of Transportation, will be able to access that information. But this is not like Ford Motor Company doing a deal with a fuel company and running out a fleet of 100 vehicles that run on algae-driven biodiesel.
It won't be presto. I want to expand our palette a little bit here to look at some of the social implications of what's going on with the price of air travel and what is yet to come. With us now from Kansas City in Missouri is Deborah Smith. She is a sociology professor at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, director of their Family Studies Program, and she studies, in particular, connectedness between generations. Deborah Smith, thanks very much for being with us.
Hello.
What do you think it means for American families if air travel becomes much more prohibitively priced?
I think families will become much more creative in keeping their connections. We're very lucky. 100 years ago, we didn't have the internet, those types of things. People actually wrote letters. Surprise. But now with the internet and phones, et cetera, that families will find a way to keep their connectedness.
So they'll be connected, but not hugging, you mean? It may be, what, a video chat or an email or a phone call. Those have become cheaper. But is that really the same thing? We're going to have, I don't know, who fills the Thanksgiving table if it's email connectedness?
It's very much a recent thing that families all gathered together. Particularly for middle-class families, people do move away for jobs and those types of things. But other families, working-class families, they don't move away. So the Thanksgiving table for them will still be filled. The middle-class families, it'll be a little bit different because people won't be able to travel as much.
You mean we're going back? I mean, I had a great uncle, and I guess during the Depression, he moved from Illinois to Olympia, Washington, became a forest ranger. The family didn't see much of him for years, and there was no estrangement. It was just too far. Are you talking that kind of thing? We just won't get together with the same frequency if people live on opposite sides of the country?
Well, you'll certainly have contact, but just by email and phone and letter and those types of things. But certainly when people migrated from the eastern coast to the Great Wild West in the late 1800s, you wouldn't see your relatives ever again, and you'd be happy if you got a letter from them once every 4 to 6 months. So this is sort of a recent American ideology that we should be able to get on a plane and go.
Andrew Goetz, how about it? Is it crazy to think that relations may get more like that again? I mean, it sounds almost unbelievable, but with oil going up so dramatically, so radically, we're starting to open our minds to things that would have seemed unthinkable not long ago. You know, when you wave someone off to, I don't know, live in Los Angeles, could that become the last a family sees of them for years?
Well, I don't know about that. I agree with the professor there about the other forms of communication that that have taken over and have made connectedness much more of a reality without the travel. But I still think, though, that the travel is still a critical part of keeping those family bonds together. And it's going to take a hit on that. I think that people are not going to be able to make as many trips, and they're not going to be able to see other members of the family quite as much. It's not like it's going to be gone forever, but at the margins, it's going to be reduced.
Can you see a culture and an economy reemerging where families are less willing to spread out? And what would that mean for the American economy?
Yeah, it could very well be a factor. You know, previously when you got a job offer from a company in another part of the country, you felt a lot freer in terms of taking it. Maybe now you're going to think twice about it and say, well, maybe there's another company here a little bit closer to where my family is, and maybe this might be a more attractive alternative.
I just feel like we're talking about giant things in motion here that are hard to get arms fully around, but we're giving it a shot. Let's take a call from Ben in Northampton, Massachusetts. Ben, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking this call. Three quick points. First of all, I think a lot of the discussion is moving the deck chairs on the Titanic. There has to be, it's not simply alternative fuels, there has to be an alternative conception of where we put our what we put our fuels into. Secondly, as far as losing contact with the family, I think the question is whether we will continue to be as dispersed as a society.
Yeah.
And whether some parts of the country will in fact simply be too expensive to live in. I specifically mean the energy-consuming, air-conditioning cultures, automobile-dependent societies of the Sun Belt.
So I look at Phoenix, Arizona, think about the water, the AC bill, the temperature, and maybe you just won't want to be there.
Yeah, Florida and so forth. Can these societies sustain themselves with the increased cost? And the ultimate solution is going to be an attempt to create an integrated rail system, which remains the most efficient way of moving goods and people. And basically, we've been profligate in our use of air travel. I mean, we shouldn't be having planes that are flying less than 500 miles per trip. It's just a lousy way of moving people, and it's very expensive, and it's not as fast given all the security considerations. So if we integrated the rail system with the air system, restricted air travel in effect to longer distances, we probably would be more efficient in airline costs and reduce those, at least relatively speaking.
Big changes coming, and we hear it, Ben. Deck chairs on the Titanic, well, I don't know if it's going down, but it's going somewhere. Deborah Smith, what about the Sunbelt observation that Ben makes here? I'm thinking particularly about the many retirees who go to the Sunbelt. You may say, well, they can email their kids and grandkids, but an awful lot of grandparents want to see and hug and give them a kiss once in a while. For example, could we see less willingness of seniors to head far south if they're worried they won't be able to afford to get back to where their kids are?
Absolutely. What usually happens is that once people retire, they might move away to the Sun Belt, but actually as they get older and more frail, they will move back to their original community for the reason for being closer to family, etc. So it could be that they just don't make that move and instead just stay in the area.
What do you think, Andrew Goetz, Sun Belt in trouble if we don't have air travel and everything else that comes along with a high AC bill and the transit needed to get there?
Yeah, well, there's a variety of different types of costs when you're talking about the Sun Belt. If you're looking at electricity, there are different ways of being able to generate electricity, different power sources that you could use.
Huge solar fields, that kind of thing?
Yeah, it's solar, wind, all sorts of alternative energies that need a tremendous amount of development. So I'm a little less concerned about the electricity side. I'm more concerned about those things that are just heavily reliant only on petroleum, which, of course, is aviation predominantly here. I think with the automobile industry, I think we're going to start to see more movement in the direction of hybrids and alternative fuels. So there, it may not be quite as much of a concern either.
But to plug and fly, not there yet. Let's go to Luke in Keene, New Hampshire. Luke, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I have made lifestyle changes. I am in New Hampshire right now. I work out in Minnesota, and I travel back and forth quite a bit. A couple years ago, I sold my car. That was a great lifestyle change and using public transportation. Now, I've cut out my flying, and I use ride-sharing off the Internet.
For long-distance travel?
Long-distance, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I have family down in Florida, and I haven't seen them for a while. So I just caught a ride out of Boston, went down to Florida, had a ride from Florida up to Minnesota, and just arrived back last week from Minnesota. It's a great way to go. I have the time to do it, you know, and people helping people out, just rideshare sites on the Internet.
Yeah, no, it sounds good. You won't pick up frequent flyer miles, but maybe some new friends. Deborah Smith, it strikes me as we talk about this that it really is a sector of American society, the middle class with a little extra money to spare, that's been doing all this flying. It's not everybody that's been flying in the millions over all these years. It's kind of the middle of the country's economic curve that we're talking about being most affected.
Absolutely, and middle class were more likely to move away for a job, just like the other professor said. So they might, again, think twice about, well, maybe I can't move out there. So one of the things that struck me during this conversation is maybe money won't be the first consideration when taking a job. And your caller just talked about having the time to do it. Maybe we think about slowing down. Maybe we think about not moving away as far. Maybe we think about things other than the dollar when deciding on what job to take.
Mickey Maynard, what's next for the airlines? Are we going to see more planes grounded, more flights cut back, more fare hikes on a larger scale, and when?
Well, we're already seeing the airlines charge passengers fees in addition to plane tickets. They started with fuel surcharges, and then a number of the airlines went to $25 charges for a second bag. Next Sunday, American Airlines starts charging $15 for the first bag for people that are purchasing the cheapest tickets. Mm-hmm. I think that we'll see the airlines charge for things that we haven't even thought about yet. I think we'll see more flights cut, more planes grounded, and it really hasn't hit yet, so watch out in fall and winter.
A lot of things we've scarcely thought about at this point may be with us soon. We've got a little glimpse of some of them today. Micheline Maynard with the New York Times joining us from Detroit. Thank you so much for being with us, Mickey.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
And Professor Andrew Goetz at the University of Denver, thanks so much for being with us.
Sure. Thank you, Tom.
And Deborah Smith at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Professor Smith, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Happy flying if you can. This is On Point.